counsel, the case is taken under advisement. Court will proceed to the third case, the United States versus Savage. Mr. Habermel.
Yes, good morning. My name is Alan Habermel. I represent Abraham Savage, the appellant in this case. With regard to the first of the two issues which we've raised, namely the sufficiency of the search warrant, I'd like to draw the court's attention to a case which actually I believe the same counsel for the government, Mr. O'Shea, was involved in, that was decided by this court just last week, United States versus Larry Kerth, K-O-E-R-T-H. That's number 01-CR-52-C1 in the trial court and 01-3767 in this court. Ironically enough, that was a case also about the sufficiency of an application for a search warrant based upon, even more ironically, my own client's statement given after he was arrested. But I think it's extremely helpful both because it clarifies several of the legal issues and the standards to be applied to addressing the issues, but also because of what I view as the extreme similarity in the facts regarding the lack of detail and corroboration in the affidavit for the warrant.
But Mr. Habermel,
yes.
Even if we were to find that the affidavit was insufficient to establish probable cause, why wouldn't the good faith exception apply? I mean, the government notes that three judges seem to think it was suggesting that it was, they suggested that it was sufficient. And what we'd be saying is that police officers should have greater knowledge of the sufficiency of a warrant than three judges.
The warrant, as the magistrate referred to it, as being tissue thin. It's obvious this particular warrant wasn't so clear cut that the judges were going, "Why, of course it's valid. Any fool could see that."
No, but that's not the standard.
Well, I understand, but my point is this: the fact that the judges ruled the way they did, they made a point of saying it was still a very close issue. Why the police officer should have known is because I think, in part, that there's a lack of analysis. And particularly in Kerth, and this is obviously my problem to deal with because they did find good faith in Kerth, and might as well hit it head on, as to why that officer should have been able to rely on the warrant. And I find it troubling because the Kerth decision refers to the fact that if the facts in the Kerth warrant had been corroborated, and if they were based upon an informant whose reliability had been demonstrated, then they would have shown probable cause. And therefore, somehow there's this leap then from that to the fact that the officer therefore could rely on it. But what I find troubling is this if, because the whole point of the fact is that the if wasn't fulfilled. There was no corroboration. There was no showing of reliability. And that's actually my answer to your question. I think in our case, the officer should have been held to the legal knowledge that was in existence at the time this warrant was issued. Obviously not the decision in Kerth that came later, but to the underlying principles on which Kerth was based and which were applicable to this warrant and were common knowledge and which this court said in Kerth an officer should be charged with. One of those is reliability of the informant. There is no attempt in the case in this court to make any effort on the part of the officer to show that this informant was reliable.
Of course, there's no evidence of bad faith here, is there?
Bad faith in the sense of actual intentional lying or misrepresenting facts, that kind of bad faith, no. I've always hated what Leon called this because they call it bad faith, but that isn't what's required to show either. Or more to the point, that's one form of bad faith. I would call that real bad faith. But by that point, you're going to get down to a Franks issue or something like that. This is more simply the officer running it past the judge and hoping it'll fly, and in this particular case, it did. But the fact of the matter is the officer was charged with knowing whether or not the informant, Schwartz, was reliable and made no effort to show that. More to the point, and I think the most difficult part about this case, is that the officer was charged with the duty, I think, to come up with some corroboration, some external investigation on the officer's part so that the officer could, in fact, and I think in good faith or reasonably then rely on Schwartz's statement. And for some reason, the officer chose not to do that. And I think it's that combination of the duty to ensure that the statement is reliable and the informant credible, because that is, after all, what protects any of us, you or me or anyone, from having some person just throw out our name and say, this person's selling drugs out of their house, go search it. And I think that's why this court really found the Kurth affidavit insufficient, because it could see that. You could put anyone's name in Savage's warrant, and it would read just the same. How do you fix that? The officer should go out and find some kind of facts, do something to show it's true. And I think this court can hold Sturtz to that duty and see that Sturtz made no effort to fulfill that duty, and therefore find that Sturtz did not reasonably act in this case, that acting solely in reliance on an uncorroborated statement from an informant of unshown reliability is not, in fact, reasonable behavior on the part of a police officer, particularly when that person's making the statement under the circumstances where it was made, where that person has an obvious motive to say anything that sounds like it will please the police. And people falsely confess to murders in this country. I mean, people do say things they didn't do because they perceive that saying those things will help them in some way. And I think that's exactly what the officer was faced with the affidavit from Schwartz. And Sturtz is an experienced officer and should have known these things. And I think acting on this information and obtaining the warrant, after all, the judge who hears Sturtz come in and file the affidavit may well assume, well, this is a police officer. She knows what she's doing. If she tells me this, this informant says these things, and the officer wants me to issue a warrant, well, I'll cut that one on behalf of the officer and give the officer the warrant. I don't think that's an entirely unreasonable position on the part of a judge. But what it does is that I think the judge then doesn't apply as much critical analysis to the contents of the warrant. It, in essence, has faith in the competence of the officer. And that's where I think the buck finally has to stop in these good faith cases, or else the whole thing just becomes it becomes self-fulfilling. If the officer acts in good faith by definition and simply applying for the warrant, and if the magistrate just assumes the officer is acting in good faith because the officer is an officer and wouldn't lie, then all the warrants are always good and you never get past that. I think this officer should be held to a duty to go further and to have investigated more and provided some additional quantum of actual corroborating evidence, and a failure to do that is, in fact, bad faith as the terms applied. I'm almost out of time. I want to briefly touch the other issue, the attribution of the drug quantities from Melissa Savage to Abraham Savage. And on that point, I want to just say, I mean, we've made the arguments in the briefs, and the court can read the record. My main problem with that is I believe what's happened is that the trial court did not believe the testimony for whatever reason, because the court had its own opinion about what it thought was going on, but substituted its opinion for the facts. All of the testimony was to the contrary. There was no actual testimony or evidence in the record to support the opinion, and I have difficulty explaining to myself or articulating why the court would think that all of those witnesses who came and testified under oath would be lying. Because if what they said is true, then we're right and the court was wrong. The court has to basically say they're lying. But to say they're lying, you'd want to think, what would be in it for them to lie? Why would they come in and lie to help Abraham Savage? What's in it for them? They were the ones dealing with Melissa in the first place. Why would they favor Abraham over Melissa and risk what you risk when you come to court and lie just to help Abraham Savage out? And if you can't come up with a satisfactory answer to that question, which I can't, then I think you have to assume they're telling the truth. And if they're telling the truth, then the trial court is just plain wrong. It has its opinion or suspicions or whatever, but all the evidence is to the contrary. And I do not believe the trial court is free to simply disregard all the evidence without some at least contradictory evidence to take its place, substituting its own opinion of what happened for the evidence presented to it, on which both sides in this particular case happen to unanimously agree, is in fact clear error, and this court should conclude a mistake was made. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hammer. Mr. O'Shea.
Good morning, Your Honors. I respectfully submit that the district court correctly found probable cause to search the Savage home for three reasons. First, Penny Schwartz provided firsthand information against her penal interest about more than $19,000 worth of methamphetamine that she'd purchased from Melissa Savage over the past 3 months. That's the first point. Secondly, as Mr. Habermel referred to the Korth case that came out last week, within that case, this court noted that in the case of drug dealers, evidence is likely found where the dealers live. And it's not just the drugs, but it's, you know, indicia of wealth and indicia of drug sales and scales and pagers and baggies and all the rest that goes along with drugs. And I think the district courts reasonably believed that evidence could be found at the Savage's home in light of what Ms. Schwartz said. Another thing that the court opinion cared about was that the fact that the informant was named. There was Abe Savage, here it is Penny Schwartz. I think that the thing there is a person does not have information when one is, when one is giving statements against one's penal interest, that's because one is already in a pickle with the police, not just because it's fun to do that. So consequently, a person has a strong incentive to give accurate information to the police. It would be crazy for Ms. Schwartz to send the police, who are already interested in her, that's why they're talking to her.
She was under arrest, wasn't she?
She was not under arrest, but her boyfriend, Ryan Kollwitz, was.
Oh, okay.
Okay. But she's making statements against her penal interest. It would be crazy for her to give information to the police, which is inaccurate, to search the home of an innocent person, because one would reasonably expect that the police, having wasted their time and woken up an innocent person in the middle of the night and ransacked their home, would be sort of ticked at Schwartz. So I think, and that's one of the things the court opinion recognizes, is a strong incentive of a person in Ms. Schwartz's position to tell the truth. As Mr. Habermel noted, that the district court correctly found good faith in the alternative in this case. And given those three factors, I respectfully submit, and as Judge Rovner noted, the three judges independently believed that the warrant, and let's face it, this was a lousy warrant, and Tina Sturz has a lot to learn, and I believe with the court opinion that I sent her this week, I believe she is learning how to more appropriately draft a warrant. I mean, the warrant is one read that raises more questions than it answers. But that's not to say that there is not good faith. Three judges reviewed it, believed that there was good faith, and she did not act unreasonably in believing it, and that's the objective standard we apply. From the government's perspective, the harder question is the second issue raised by Mr. Habermel, and that is whether the district court was clearly erroneous in attributing to Abraham Savage marijuana sold by his wife, Melissa Savage, over the summer of 2000. The United States continues to believe that the weight of the evidence is against the district court's decision to attribute the drugs. But the clear error question is whether there's any evidence that supports the district court's opinion, whether the district court's view of the evidence is impermissible. And while we did...
There is some evidence, isn't there, that when Abe was not at home, his wife was filling his orders.
Correct.
And, of course, she was seems to have been terribly controlled by Abe.
That's exactly right. Not only did she fill orders while he was out, but also when Abe Savage was in custody, Abe Savage sent Melissa Savage around to go collect on his drug debts. Recall the testimony of Mr. Parrish. So even from inside the jail, Mr. Savage was able to control Melissa Savage.
Mr. O'Shea, you strongly opposed attributing the drugs to Abraham at sentencing, right?
Correct.
And you have a different view of that at appeal?
No, Your Honor. But, Alan Habermel and I were talking about that, why the government is taking this position. And I think it's because of the institutional, it's the court's decision to weigh the facts. And I believe it's our institutional obligation not to interpose our own judgment and declare error just because the district court didn't agree with us.
Judge Grab didn't pluck this out of thin air. She had her reasons.
Right.
And she stated them quite cogently on the record.
Right. And it's not a question. The district court didn't find that that these witnesses lied. She felt that they were wrong, that they'd been misled by Abraham Savage for three different reasons. First of all, Melissa Savage, during the summer of 2000, was selling drugs to Ryan Kollwitz, one of Abe Savage's customers. And the district court found it improbable that Abe Savage would just let this customer go and not lure him back to the customer base. And that's why she felt it you know,
how does the judge arrive at the conclusion of the amount of drugs in Loomer, Wisconsin?
Well,
how does she arrive at the conclusion? How many people are dealing? I mean, I understand evidence
right.
about when you produce it.
Right.
How do you make an assessment? I have a difficult time making an assessment amount of drugs in Chicago or in a suburb. I just wonder
right.
what was before the judge that gives us some feeling that this is more than some anecdotal assessment of
right.
an experienced judge, clearly.
Right, right. And it's experience. It's knowing the district, really. I mean, Bloomer is a small town in a rural area. Now, I think it's similar to the Ornelas case where the Supreme Court said, hey, look, you know, these are a couple of guys who are driving through Milwaukee. They've got California plates. You know, they're probably not tourists. So it's, you know, I should note that it was January when these California people went through it. No knock on Milwaukee.
We all know no one in their right mind would come from California to Wisconsin.
Well, and I believe it was Judge Rehnquist, a Milwaukee guy, who authored that opinion. So I think it's just knowledge of one's district. You can use them applying one's common sense to it. I mean, it's a small town. And it wasn't so much that the district court knew how many drug dealers, but it was a question of whether or not reasonably word would get back to Abe Savage and he would put a stop to her drug dealing, unless, of course, as she concluded, that Abe Savage really was behind all of it. So while I disagreed then and I disagree now, I respectfully submit that the district court was not clearly erroneous in attributing these weights to Abraham Savage. And that's all I have, unless there are any other questions.
All right, Judge Mannion, do you have any questions of Mr. O'Shea?
I have done some cross-country skiing, actually, in the city of Milwaukee myself, but that was an unusual situation.
Thank you, Mr. O'Shea. Mr. Havanaugh.
To go back to the Warren issue for a minute, everything that Mr. O'Shea said that he argued would justify finding probable cause in this case was present in Kurth, and his court rejected it. Savage, the informant in Kurth, gave very detailed information based on what he claimed to be firsthand observation, described a large quantity of drugs and dollar amounts, claimed to be personally purchasing. He was named. All of that was exactly identical, and this court said it wasn't enough. And the reasons it wasn't enough is that Savage's reliability wasn't established and that there was no corroboration whatsoever. His statements essentially boiled down to conclusions. That is to say, in this court's words, mere assertions of wrongdoing without an adequate factual foundation based on the testimony of a previously unknown informant. You can substitute Schwartz and Savage for Savage and Kurth, and you get exactly the same factual standards. And I think the same result is required for the same reasons. And the good faith issue, again, then boils down to whether Ms. Sturtz, who, as the government admits, is laconic at best when she writes applications for search warrants, nonetheless should have known as an experienced officer working in the drug field that some kind of corroboration of the reliability of the informant and the nature of the information is required before you just go around pounding on people's doors in the middle of the night. And I think that's what separates that case from the run-of-the-mill cases where you might have a more technical or whatever kind of argument over the warrant. This one was, I just think, plainly lacking, and the officer should have known that. And her failure to act on that knowledge she should have had, I think, makes it objectively unreasonable, and that's what bad faith is. With regard to the attribution of the drug amounts, the problem there is that the judge said, for instance, well, the judge's basic theory seems to be that Abe Savage was simply using Melissa in this very clever and devious way. But the fact of the matter is, if he had displeased his customer by stepping too hard on the drugs and the customer came back and said, this stuff is crud, why wouldn't he just give him better drugs? Why go through this incredibly complex charade of having Melissa front for him? It makes no sense. And why would then Melissa and Kollwitz go through this charade of hiding it from Abe? Kollwitz knew that if Abe found out, he might put a stop to it because he was in competition. Melissa was in competition with Abe, and Abe would not like that. Why would he be afraid of Abe putting a stop to it from finding out if that weren't true? So, again, I think the picture presented by the evidence is accurate, and the judge rejected it simply out of her opinion, and that's conjecture and not evidence, and should be overturned. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Hammerwell. Thanks, Mr. O'Shea and Mr.